Hello, and happy Sunday. Thank you for tuning in to this March 21st edition of The Rewind, your Sunday news magazine. I'm your host, Robert Kaplan. On today's episode, students hoping to study abroad are shifting their timelines to adjust for the disruptions of the pandemic, while Tufts broadens its offerings. A Green Fund project aims to help students recycle smarter using an innovative, low-cost approach. But first, I talk with Deputy News Editor Sarah Sandlow about her reporting on the state of Massachusetts vaccine rollout and Tufts vaccination plans. Hello, Sarah. Thanks for joining us today.
Yes, of course. Nice to talk to you.
Lovely. Let's get started. So the news of the week is that Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker announced just a couple days ago the remaining schedule for vaccine distribution, with the general public 16 years and older, will be eligible in the state to receive the vaccine as of April 19th, with a couple phases before. So we have you here to talk about Tufts vaccination distribution. Let's get started with the basics. Does Tufts have a vaccine inventory? Does it intend to? If it does, how many vaccines does it have?
So currently the university doesn't have a vaccine supply. They did receive a limited amount of vaccines, but because they do receive the vaccines from the state of Massachusetts, most of those vaccines distributed through the state will go to either mass vaccination sites or pharmacies at this point in the rollout.
Okay. To the extent that Tufts members of the community are eligible for vaccines, does Tufts have a role in getting them that vaccine? Does it connect them to third-party providers? What does that look like?
So I was told by Dr. Caggiano that around 100 individuals at Tufts have been vaccinated by Tufts, but she didn't mention how the vaccine process was actually conducted. But she did say that this group includes the healthcare workers, people who met the age requirements for the certain phases that have already been rolled out, and certain first responders. She also told me that the first responders were vaccinated through the cities of Somerville and Worcester.
Okay. Kind of a follow-up to that. Is Tufts requiring any of its employees to be vaccinated before we talk about students?
That I don't know. I think that people on TEMS have been vaccinated from the people on TEMS that I've talked to, but other than that, I'm not sure.
Okay. What about for the future? Is Tufts planning or prepared to administer vaccines to the Tufts community? If so, how?
From what I've heard from Dr. Jordan and Dr. Caggiano, Tufts definitely does have plans to administer vaccines once there is enough of a supply to do so. Many of my questions on this topic were met with a little bit of uncertainty because the university hasn't established a set plan because there is no vaccine supply at this moment. Dr. Caggiano said that Tufts is planning on how to administer larger quantities of the vaccine once it's available, but she didn't share any details on how that would look. Ultimately, the university is prepared to administer vaccines, and all they're waiting for is a supply from the state.
Two follow-up questions to that. One, would that be in the form of like an on-campus clinic? Where would that be? What would that look like?
So in many of the emails that were sent by the university, specifically the one sent on February 18th, Dr. Jordan stated that Tufts doesn't have enough vaccinations to host a kind of on-campus clinic right now, but they are planning on vaccinating many people per day in Ganscher once they have the supply to do so. And as of right now, they're advising people who are eligible at this time to go through outside sources such as CVS or other mass vaccination sites.
Okay. So is the only condition that Tufts is waiting for to be provided some supply, or are there additional permissions that it needs?
I think they're just waiting on a supply. Again, I had asked about the vaccination clinic, but there are no set plans that they were able to give me because of the lack of supply.
Right. A lot of wait and see, it sounds like.
Yes.
From those who you have talked to, both that you've interviewed yourself, of those who have been vaccinated and others you've heard about, what are the types of people among students who have been vaccinated already so far?
So I've been hearing about more students who've been vaccinated, mostly those who work at hospitals in Boston like MGH or Brigham and Women's. They've been vaccinated through their employers. And then, like I said before, students who are on TEMS have been vaccinated as well. And for my article, I interviewed a sophomore who has POTS, which stands for postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome, which made her eligible for the phase 2 group 2 part of the vaccine rollout in Massachusetts. And she told me that she was vaccinated through CVS in Massachusetts and that she would receive her second dose of the vaccine at the end of March. And she did mention that Tufts did not contact her about her eligibility in this phase, but she did the research to obtain the vaccine on her own.
Additional question I want to get in here. Tufts, because of a Massachusetts announcement, required that everybody get the flu shot and facilitated on-campus clinics for that, you know, a while ago. Tufts hasn't said that the vaccine will be required before students come back. You all
right? Right. Dr. Caggiano told me that the vaccine wasn't required or mandatory for students or faculty or staff on Tufts, but they strongly suggest that people get vaccinated before coming back to campus in the fall. Dr. Caggiano did tell me that if students are eligible and they leave campus before getting a vaccine, they're encouraged to do more research within their home state in order to obtain a vaccine before coming back in the fall. But no, it's not required from what I know.
All right, on that last point, now that they're just in the past couple days, we've heard that they're in the future, Massachusetts is going to begin general distribution to the adult public. And what's the mood on campus from people that you've talked to?
I think the general mood regarding the possibility that we may be able to be vaccinated in April is kind of a sense of anticipation and excitement. I mean, it has been over a year since the pandemic hit, and everybody's been waiting pretty long for this. So as of now, I'm not sure what students are expecting in terms of receiving the vaccine on campus or the ways that they'll be vaccinated once they're eligible. But I know that most people I've talked to are excited that they will be vaccinated in the coming months.
Okay, lovely. Well, it's been great having you here.
Thank you.
On March 11th, the one-year anniversary since the World Health Organization declared COVID-19 a global pandemic, President Joe Biden delivered his first televised national address. In that address, Biden announced that he will direct states to make all adults, ages 18 and older, eligible for the coronavirus vaccines by May 1st. Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker announced Wednesday that those in the Commonwealth who are ages 16 and up will be eligible for a COVID-19 vaccine on April 19th, which is Patriots Day in the Northeast. Tomorrow, Massachusetts residents who are 60 years and older and many frontline workers will become eligible for a vaccine. The Rewind's own Amelia Becker spoke with students about their plans to study abroad. Many have had to shift their timelines due to the pandemic, with some opting to study abroad in the spring of their senior year. Amelia Becker has the story.
Last March, students studying abroad rushed to get home amid the unfolding pandemic. This March, students are looking ahead to future study abroad opportunities. Junior Trevor Hall has always wanted to study abroad and was planning on enrolling in the Tufts in London program this year. With the program being canceled for the 2020-2021 school year, Hall changed his plans. To fulfill all of his major requirements and still study abroad, Hall must travel abroad his senior spring, something outside the norm that brings up new issues. One of these is that the Tufts in London program ends in June, while Tufts graduation takes place in May. Even so, Hall wants to take advantage of the opportunity to study abroad through Tufts.
I'll honestly be done with my major and I could graduate early, a semester early, but I'll just take advantage of the Tufts opportunity that I have and go abroad for another semester and then technically graduate after that.
Hall has communicated with Assistant Director of Tufts Global Education, Melanie Armstrong, the study abroad coordinator in London, and his advisor to organize his plans. Tufts Global Education has offered a variety of virtual information sessions, panels, and activities to help support students and connect them with program staff abroad. In the past, seniors were required to choose between a senior honors thesis or study abroad. However, the office has worked closely with the deans of undergraduate education and the advising deans to allow students to work on senior honors theses abroad. Further, the office has increased the offerings of a few Tufts study abroad programs to accommodate a larger pool of applicants. Hall said he would only reconsider studying abroad if he knew his study abroad experience would be severely limited because of another outbreak of COVID-19, or if he wouldn't have support systems in place.
And if you don't have a support system around you, like abroad, then you're gonna have a bad experience. So like if I felt like I didn't have a support system and a group of kids also when I went abroad to go with, I probably would change my decision.
Oliver Diamond, a sophomore, was accepted to the Tufts in Chile program for spring 2022. He's planning to attend and said he would only reconsider if another outbreak prevented him from gaining the full experience in Chile. Like Hall, Diamond has always wanted to study abroad in college. He wants to go to a Spanish-speaking country to improve his language skills, and the Tufts in Chile program provides the opportunity to do so. Diamond's Spanish teacher supported him throughout the application process.
Luckily, I kind of knew what I was looking for, so I was able to keep track of that stuff. And also, my Spanish teacher had sent out a lot of messages to keep us informed about different study abroad opportunities. So that was really helpful. I would say that's really helpful for language teachers to spread the message. I think that's a really helpful aspect.
However, he did face a few technical issues with the new website and application portal.
They've just been building the website. I had some trouble where I got in. But then it said that my thing was starting in 2020, basically starting in March 2021. So in 2 weeks from now, I was supposed to be starting according to what it said on the details of the program. So I had to call the office and come back, basically, and clarify that I wasn't leaving in 2 weeks.
Tufts Global Education launched a new application portal this year to gauge student interest. Through the portal, staff have increased communications with students, and they hope to improve student engagement. Many students hoping to study abroad next year are planning to do so in the spring. Both Diamond and sophomore Grace Spaulding Fetcher had initially wanted to study abroad in the fall of their junior years, but changed their plans as a result of the pandemic.
It seems more likely that by the spring, things will be more back to normal, or just a lot more things will be open and available. So I changed my mind from applying for the fall.
Spaulding Fetcher, who was accepted to the Tufts in Paris program for spring 2022, said she talked through the decision of whether to study abroad in the fall or the spring with Melanie Armstrong.
And while obviously she couldn't, she doesn't know what the situation in the fall is going to be like. So, in that way, she couldn't give me a direct answer about that, which was my main question. But she was able to offer some really helpful insight, just thinking about the logistics of visas and thinking about the possibilities of other countries letting people from the US come in and how that could impact applying for a visa and like when you would get it.
She came away from the meeting set on spring. Even though Spaulding Fetcher was concerned about missing her Frisbee season, which takes place in the spring, and a hopefully normal semester on campus, spring seemed like the safest option for study abroad. She is looking forward to the chance to travel and immerse herself in a new place, especially after the pandemic has confined many people to one location.
And also being able to travel, most of my like closest friends are also planning on being in Europe, and so the thought of being able to visit them and travel throughout Europe is really exciting.
For all those planning to study abroad next year, there's a sense of cautious optimism about the possibilities. For The Rewind, I'm Amelia Becker.
In the news this week, Somerville Public Schools opened its new high school to students on March 4th. The building is designed to accommodate nearly 1,600 students, though only a limited number of students are currently permitted in the building as part of the school's phased return to in-person learning. Currently, high-need students and multilingual learning lab students are allowed in the building full-time. The Tufts Community Union Senate has called for the university to mandate an in-person component for every course next semester. TCU Senator for the Class of 2024, Claire Bolash, submitted the resolution, which passed the Senate 16-8 with one senator opting to abstain. The administration said it will adjust its plans according to government regulation and the advice of medical experts, and that it hopes that conditions in the fall will allow for more in-person instruction. Massachusetts' entire congressional delegation is criticizing the MBTA over its pandemic-related service cuts. In recent weeks, the MBTA has reduced service by up to 20% on the green, orange, and red lines, and has, on many lines, eliminated weekend access to the commuter rail. The MBTA said cuts were made in response to lower levels of ridership due to the pandemic, though critics are quick to point out that the agency has received more than $1 billion from federal COVID-19 relief aid. Coming up this week is a whole series of events hosted by Tusk as part of its Staycation series. The series features events such as a cacti and bamboo grab and go, where you can take home one or more plants free of charge, lawn games on the academic quad, and a community chalk mural. Week-long kickboxing, Zumba, and yoga classes are also on the schedule. You can find dates and times for these events on the Tusk website. Tufts Global Education is on Wednesday hosting an event titled Black Lives Matter Around the World. The event is the third virtual event of the department's Critical Times, Critical Thinkers series, and will feature speakers from the United States, Spain, Germany, and Jamaica. Speakers will talk about the historical, social, and cultural expressions of Black Lives Matter from across the globe. Registration for the event is required and can be found by going to tufts.presence.io. According to a 2018 report by the Environmental Protection Agency, the U.S. recycling rate has increased from just 6% in 1960, when the EPA first started reporting on these figures, to 32% in 2018. However, the amount of waste generated by Americans has increased more than threefold over the same period, from 88.1 million tons in 1960 to 292.4 million tons in 2018. At Tufts, the total amount of waste generated on campus has decreased over time, according to Tufts Facility Services. These data, however, stop in 2017 and thus do not include the rise in waste due to COVID-19 precautions. According to Facility Services, Tufts recycled 48% of its waste in 2017. Producer Ryan Schaefer spoke with senior Mia Nixon about her project to improve recycling habits on campus. Nixon says the key to recycling more without contaminating the recycling stream is to simply know what is recyclable. Ryan Schaefer has the story.
In 2018, the U.S. generated more than 292 million tons of waste, according to the Environmental Protection Agency's 2018 report titled Advancing Sustainable Materials Management. Much of that waste can be recycled, with some estimates as high as 75%. However, only approximately 32% of U.S. waste in 2018 was recycled or composted. Senior Mia Nixon thinks there's at least one simple factor leading to these low rates. We simply don't know what to recycle.
I don't know if you've ever been in a situation where you have an empty container and you're at the recycling bin and you kind of have this inner debate in your head about whether or not, you know, you can recycle that item. This definitely happens to me all the time. And there's just a lot of inconsistencies about what can be recycled, you know, within actual schools, within states. Everybody just has different guidelines.
According to the Recycling and Waste Management Office within Tufts Operations Division, 48% of solid waste on campus in 2017 was recycled or composted. In December, Nixon proposed the project Flow Green to the Tufts Green Fund, a program that provides funding for sustainability projects in Tufts community. Flow Green is an easy, low-cost approach to improve recycling habits on campus by posting QR codes on recycling bins across campus that will direct users to a website where they can learn more about Massachusetts recycling guidelines. The Green Fund accepted Nixon's proposal, granting the project roughly $3,600 to develop and implement. Nixon walked through how users can utilize Flow Green when recycling.
What Flow Green does is it uses QR code technology, and QR code technology, just for reference, is basically, it's like a barcode. You open up your phone, open up the camera on your phone, point it at the QR code, which is just a circular code, and essentially scan it. And then a little banner will pop up at the top of your screen and you can click on it and it'll send you to some sort of online platform wherever, you know, the code has, you've dedicated the code to send you. And for Flow Green, it's sending you to a website called Recycle Smart MA. And on that website, there's a search bar where you can put in whatever item you are planning on recycling. And most likely it will have a tab for that and you can click on it. Like, I was just looking at plastic coffee cups, and it'll tell you exactly if that item is recyclable. And then it will also give you instructions, detailed instructions on how to recycle it. You know, the take off the lid and the straw, put those in the garbage can, and then make sure all the liquid is out of the cup, and then you can recycle it.
Recycling, or the lack thereof, has significant impacts on carbon emission. According to the World Economic Forum, manufacturing 4 plastic bottles produces the same amount of greenhouse gases as driving 1 mile in a car. On the national scale, the EPA estimates that 3 million tons of plastic recycled in 2018 is the equivalent of taking 890,000 cars off the road for 1 year. The overwhelming majority of greenhouse gas reduction and recycling, however, comes from recycled paper and paperboard. The 46 million tons of paper and paperboard recycled in 2018 resulted in a reduction of emissions equivalent to removing over 33 million cars from the road for 1 year. Nixon says FlowGreen can be easily adopted by municipalities, universities, and communities across the U.S. because of its low cost. The program's startup costs include money for flyers, logo design and development, QR code stickers, and website development and management. According to Nixon's Green Fund application, once the program is in place at Tufts, it will not require additional funding beyond educating new students each year. Nixon says the project is unique in its scalability.
Yeah, I think that's what I'm trying to get out of FlowGreen is the fact that it is so simple and so low cost that once we get it to work here at Tufts campus, I'm hoping to scale it to, you know, universities near us like Harvard and MIT and other schools. And then once we get it there, you know, spread, it's so easy and low cost that it's highly scalable. And that's what I think is so exciting about this is that it's just so easy to implement everywhere that then we can get, you know, gain a greater awareness around it and even bring it to certain, you know, towns and municipalities like that and like put it on public recycling bins just outside. So that's kind of the main goal with the project in terms of scaling.
Nixon first got the idea over the summer while interning at Flowcode, a year-old startup company that offers users the ability to create free QR codes that do not expire.
It definitely, this idea came to be over the summer. We pitched it to, I had an internship with a company called Flowcode, who makes these circular QR codes that we're going to be putting on the bins around campus. And they had this really fun pitch competition where they invited all of the employees and interns to pitch kind of a use case for their product, because they're about 1 year old startup company. And me and another intern decided to get together and came up with this idea for FlowGreen and pitched it to them. And they were really excited about it and agreed to fund us implementing it in my hometown in Connecticut.
Currently, FlowGreen is designing QR codes and gearing up for the pilot program launch, which will take place before the end of April. Nixon says the QR code stickers will be roughly the size of your palm and be placed at the top of recycling bin lids. Using FlowGreen's technology, Nixon shows how students can make informed decisions on whether to recycle a particular item. For example, plastic cutlery.
So it says, put this item in your trash bin, which honestly, I wouldn't have known what to do with that object. So now we know that goes in your trash bin. Simple as that.
Coffee cups.
Yep. So we have that one because, as I said, I was just looking at that. This item is put in your trash bin.
Brown paper bags.
So when I type brown, the first thing that comes up is actually brown paper bags, but it also says in parentheses, clean and dry, which I like when it kind of uses that. That's why I really think this is a great website because it just has those specifics. So it says brown paper bags, clean and dry, put this item in your recycling bin. But I think it's really important to note that clean and dry part because if for some reason it is, contaminated with some sort of oil that came from the food, then it's not recyclable anymore.
Pizza boxes.
This is a good one. I don't even need to look this one up because I thought originally you could always recycle pizza boxes, and then I learned you couldn't because the grease was contaminating it. And then I looked it up on this website, and it actually does say put this item in your recycling bin. Says you can put empty pizza boxes in the recycling, and grease is actually okay. And then it has a whole lot of other parts, like this whole paragraph about it says, basically, helpful suggestion, fold the box inside out before you put it in the recycling bin. This will make sure that the box is completely empty so that there's no surprises at the sorting facility. And liners and pizza savers go in the trash. So it just has that level of, you know, such detail that really helps you know exactly what you need to do with what you're recycling.
And plastic takeout containers from, say, a dining hall, or rather, rigid plastic.
The actual container is recyclable, but the thing to note, so the instructions for this says rinse or wipe clean all food residue. Let's see, recycle non-black takeout containers only. Black plastic should be placed in the trash because it is missed by optical sorters at recycling sorting facilities and will either end up in the trash or contaminating other materials.
Knowing what can or cannot be recycled can have a large impact on whether the item and the items thrown away with it are recycled. In other words, items that are not recyclable can contaminate other items in the bin, thus making the whole bin non-recyclable. About 25% of the items we try to recycle are too contaminated and therefore diverted to a landfill, according to the National Waste and Recycling Association, up from 7% just over a decade ago.
Part of what a lot of people don't know, and what I didn't know, you know, about a year ago, is that it's better to recycle as much as possible and recycle like everything rather than, you know, even if it might belong in the trash, it's better to just try and recycle it anyways. But that's actually not the case, because there are consequences to recycling items that are non-recyclable, because it can contaminate that entire bin of recycling and then end up making it all go to the landfill, including a lot of things that could have been recycled. So that's really important to get across. And then why I love, again, this website is just so detailed about it, because it's really important to separate those items and not recycle something that can end up contaminating the rest of the bin.
For The Rewind, I'm Ryan Schaefer.
And that's it for this March 21st edition of The Rewind. I've been your host, Robert Kaplan. We'll be out next week for spring break, so join us back on April 4th for more stories from the Tufts Daily.
The Rewind is brought to you by the Tufts Daily. Today's episode was produced in part by McKenna Law, with reporting by Amelia Becker and producer Ryan Schaefer. I, Kate Seckler, select the music. Robert Kaplan is our host. Hannah Harris is executive audio producer. Thank you for listening.